This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, July 25th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening today. And we begin this hour with the Justice Department and its leader under attack. President Trump is stepping up his assault on his own attorney general, former Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions. It's a stunning turn of events for a relationship that dates back years. Sessions and President Trump have known each other since 2005. When Trump ran for president, even when others didn't take him seriously, Jeff Sessions did. He was an early and vocal supporter and the first and, for a time, the only senator to endorse Trump's candidacy. But now, with the Russia investigation intensifying, the president has turned on his one-time ally. Here's President Trump last week in an interview with the New York Times.
Sessions should have never recused himself. And if he was going to recuse himself, he should have told me before he took the job and I would have picked somebody else.
In response, the attorney general has said that he would stay on in his job for, quote, as long as is appropriate. But that's just the start. On Monday, the president attacked Jeff Sessions for failing to investigate Hillary Clinton, calling him beleaguered. Yesterday, in front of a crowd of Boy Scouts, the president lamented a lack of loyalty around him, though Jeff Sessions, himself an Eagle Scout, wasn't there. And this morning, several more tweets attacking Jeff Sessions for not investigating Hillary Clinton and leaks. It's an extraordinary public humiliation of the attorney general by a president who so far has chosen not to simply fire him. But what's the president's endgame here? Why is he going after Sessions? And what does it mean for both the special prosecutor's investigation into the president and for the integrity and historical independence of the attorney general's office and the Justice Department itself? Stuart Gerson is with me in the studio. He was assistant attorney general in the George H.W. Bush administration from 1989 to 93, and he was the acting attorney general in the Clinton administration in 1993. He's now a private attorney at Epstein, Becker, and Green. Stuart Gerson, welcome.
Thank you, Todd. It's good to be here.
You have been acting attorney general, as I said, a job that's supposed to be imbued with independence. The president is going after his own AG basically for not shielding him from an investigation and for not prosecuting his political opponents, Hillary Clinton. He's mentioned it in his tweets. You've been watching this along with the rest of us. What do you make of all this?
Well, his claim or demand for personal representation in the Justice Department is quite anomalous. That's not the business of the Justice Department. The Attorney General is the lawyer of all the people. He's the representative of the United States in legal proceedings and legal policy, and that independence is important. I had the luxury of it, a Republican conservative serving accidentally for a liberal Democrat. It worked fine. It's unusual, the situation we're in today. I mean, we've had times in recent months where others were reported to be on their way out, Steve Bannon, the most notorious of them. This could pass. I think the end game is the same either way, whether the president removes the attorney general or whether Jeff Sessions decides to leave. The president is going to face exactly the same problem.
And I want to get to that end game. First, I want to play you the new White House communications director, Anthony Scaramucci. He was on the Hugh Hewitt show this morning, where Hugh Hewitt got to this very point of this public attack and humiliation and why the president simply doesn't fire a member of his cabinet.
It's clear the president wants him gone. Is that an Anthony?
I have an enormous amount of respect for the attorney general. But I do know the president pretty well, and if there's this level of tension in the relationship that's public, you're probably right. But I don't want to speak for the president on that because he's a cabinet official, and I sort of think that has to be between the president of the United States and the cabinet official.
Stuart Gerson, you've been a cabinet official, at least an acting one, and you've uttered that Washington phrase, "I serve at the pleasure of the president," I'm sure. Why doesn't the president simply fire Jeff Sessions?
Well, I think he'd rather that Sessions left on his own. But at least if you follow the new communication director's lead, we may have a foregone conclusion later on in the day.
Now, you've talked about the end game and why you think all of this is going on. It doesn't seem like it can be about much else besides Robert Mueller and the special counsel investigation and the ongoing FBI investigation into Russian meddling.
Absolutely. I mean, it's clear that that's what it's about, and why I said a little bit earlier that the end game is pretty much the same whether the president fires the attorney general or the attorney general removes himself, because at the end of the day, you got to get another attorney general. And that's not going to come easily. You can predict in the Senate that Republicans will join Democrats in asking any future nominee, what is he going to do with respect to the investigation? Is he going to recuse himself if he's been a campaign official? Is he in the same boat that Sessions was in, who I submit properly recused himself? And if the individual actually is confirmed, is he going to fire Bob Mueller?
And you have a president who seems uniquely and specifically focused on one issue, and that's Mueller. You were in the Justice Department the first time the country went through something similar. Where does this get us? Where does it get the president?
Well, it doesn't get us anyplace good. I mean, we need to get past it. Bob Mueller is a person who I know very well. I've worked with him for years, and well, we're not close friends. We see each other from time to time. He's a person of superlative ethics and good organizational skills. I mean, in a better world, in a perfect world, there would be no discussion of what he's doing until he's finished.
Members of Congress who we discussed, you said they would have to respond if the president went about firing the attorney general to try to get to Bob Mueller, and if this went down the line sort of the way it did in the Nixon years. Republicans in Congress have shown very little appetite so far to confront the president on his violations of democratic norms or setting aside of those norms so far. From what you've observed from this Congress and its leaders, do you expect that getting rid of Jeff Sessions and getting to Mueller in this way would spark a response?
Well, I don't expect anybody's going to jump on the impeachment bandwagon, but I think you can be guaranteed two things. First, Jeff Sessions served in the Senate. He has some friends there still. He was well regarded. He worked with people on both sides and was an effective senator. Bob Mueller is a person who enjoys a great reputation among Republicans and Democrats alike. He is a Republican. He served in a Republican administration. You can bet that if there's not an immediate reaction to do this or that, there will necessarily be one in conjunction with any confirmation hearing of whomever would be appointed to succeed Jeff Sessions.
Here's the last critical question, Stuart Gerson, before we let you go. Bob Mueller, all of this swirling around him as he does his work, do you expect that any of this dissuades him?
Bob Mueller served with distinction in Vietnam, won the Bronze Star. I think there was a lot more swirling around him then than there is now.
Stuart Gerson was Assistant Attorney General in the administration of George H.W. Bush. He was Acting Attorney General in the Clinton administration in 1993. Stuart Gerson, thank you for joining and for giving your experience and insight here.
Thank you, Todd.
Follow me, boys, follow me.
What do you think the chances are that this incredible, massive crowd, record-setting, is going to be shown on television tonight? 1% or zero?
Follow me. Pick them up, put them down, pick them up.
You know, I go to Washington and I see all these politicians and I see the swamp, and it's not a good place. In fact, today I said we ought to change it from the word swamp to the word cesspool, or perhaps to the word sewer. By the way, just a question. Did President Obama ever come to a jamboree?
It's a long, long.
That's just some of what President Trump said to more than 35,000 Boy Scouts at the organization's National Jamboree yesterday. Now, it's a longstanding tradition for the Scouts to invite the sitting president to speak at their jamboree. It includes tens of thousands of young people. But Trump's politically charged address was far from the norm. The president's remarks are now being sharply criticized by many inside and outside of the Scouts, including many parents of Scouts. DeShane Stokes is an Eagle Scout and a former adult leader. He joins me now. DeShane, welcome.
Thank you.
What was your reaction when you heard the president? We heard some of his remarks there talking about his electoral win, calling Washington a cesspool, and attacking Hillary Clinton in his speech.
I was sickened and outraged by what he got up there and did before the Boy Scouts. It was a complete outrage. Normally, when a president gets up and speaks before the jamboree, they're usually talking about things like citizenship, fellowship with fellow citizens, and he instead used the opportunity to get up there and aggrandize himself and talk about his victories and how he's going to, you know, all these different things with his victories. Even though he's the honorary president of the Boy Scouts of America, you know, which is customarily reserved for the president of the United States, he really had no idea what the Boy Scouts of America is really about. I mean, the Boy Scout law, for example, says that a scout is trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent. And he got up there and used the opportunity to aggrandize himself and just talk about himself and boast about himself rather than talking about how these children, these future leaders and future men of America can go about being trustworthy and loyal and actually helping their fellow citizens.
You've been in touch with not only a lot of scouts, but parents, I'm sure, online on Facebook and elsewhere. What's the reaction been?
I've heard a lot of people who are similarly really upset about what Trump got up there and did. People are really upset. A lot of them who are fellow scouts or people who were in scouts, even people who have come from families, multiple generations of scouts, are really pissed off about what he did.
What do you think that young scouts, though, who were in the crowd, might want to take away about their own behavior? There were a lot of cheers, again, booing Hillary Clinton at the president's prompting. Maybe it's reasonable to expect a young boy to follow an adult in that way. That instance didn't seem terribly scout-like either.
That's something that really worries me about how this is going to affect our children. Naturally, people in America look up to the American president. He's considered a role model. And boys and the Boy Scouts are there to learn how to become men and the future leaders of America. So what Trump did is definitely setting a precedent for what they're going to do themselves in their own lives. And the messages of racism, the lies, the fraud, the sexism, like he's sending a lot of really horrible messages to our children.
Do you think the president should speak at the Jamboree next year?
No, definitely not.
One view from an Eagle Scout on the president's speech in front of the annual Boy Scouts Jamboree in West Virginia, DeShane Stokes, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
The Boy Scouts of America released a statement today saying it is a wholly nonpartisan organization.
Follow me, boys, follow me. When you think you're really beat, that's the time to lift your feet and follow me. Boys, follow me. Pick them up, put them down and follow me. Pick them up, put them down and follow me.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. On Monday, a federal judge ruled that President Trump's Commission on Election Integrity may seek voter data from 50 states and the District of Columbia. Now, several states had resisted that move, and the stated intent of the commission is to rout out voter fraud in the United States, which in fact is exceedingly rare. The Brennan Center for Justice estimates that voter fraud affects about 1 in 25,000 ballots in U.S. elections. But in June, at the same time that that commission made its first request for information on millions of voters, the Department of Justice sent out a request of its own requiring 44 states to provide information on how they keep voter rolls up to date. Now, the request cited the 1993 National Voter Registration Act. It's also known as the Motor Voter Law. And it sparked concern that instead of expanding voter registration, which is the point of the law, that the Justice Department was trying to influence purging voter rolls. Vinita Gupta is the president and chief executive of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. She was head of the Civil Rights Division at the Department of Justice from 2014 until 2017. Vinita Gupta, welcome.
Hi, nice to be here.
You have said that the Department of Justice asking states to tell it how they maintain their lists, their voter lists, isn't an effort to expand registration, but ultimately to purge those lists. Why do you say that?
The Justice Department's letter to all of the states that are covered by the motor voter law is virtually unprecedented. Usually, the Justice Department would ask a single state for data if there was direct evidence that the state wasn't complying with the motor voter bill. Here, they asked all of the states that are covered. And though the motor voter law actually was mandates that states actually help voters register through motor vehicle departments and expand access to voter registration, this letter focuses on a very narrow set of questions about how states maintain their voter rolls, and that is a prelude to voter purging.
So that means the questions that DOJ is asking the states about the integrity of maintaining their voter lists suggest that they think that there are people on those voter lists who should be kicked off?
Yeah, I mean, there's really two parallel efforts happening right now in the Trump administration. One is this effort by the Justice Department, which got a lot less attention than the Pence-Kobach Commission. The Justice Department's letter now can force states to respond with the data that it has requested, and presumably to create some sort of national database that is going to try to find things like double voters. And let me explain that for a second. The Pence-Kobach Commission, established after President Trump claimed, with no evidence to back it up whatsoever, that 3 to 5 million voters may have voted in the 2016 election illegally, also exists to create a national database to try to find things like double voters. The problem is, in both of these instances, but certainly with the commission's not going to be able to tell two people who have the same name and birthday apart. These kinds of errors are going to hit communities of color the hardest. We know that because census data shows that minorities are overrepresented in 85 of 100 of the most common last names. This has been an effort that has been undertaken in states like Georgia and Ohio that have been sued for carrying out early versions of what we can expect here from the Trump administration. This has been a single-minded effort by Kris Kobach, who has had a – who's really been at the vanguard of a crusade against the motor voter bill, who's been seeking to get it amended, who's been sued numerous times for making it harder for Kansans to vote. He's the Secretary of State in Kansas. But right before the 2016 election, he had actually illegally blocked tens of thousands of voters from registering. So this is a very concerning development, and certainly indicates a broader effort on the part of the administration to restrict the right to vote and to hamper voter participation in our democracy.
States have now seen this letter. How does it work on a practical level if what you say is true, that the Department of Justice is opening prelude to voter purges? How would that work?
So the states will need to send over the detailed information that the Justice Department has requested on this very narrow set of questions. And then presumably the Justice Department will analyze that information, verify and confirm whether states are actually adequately complying with maintaining the voter lists in the states. And look, there's no question that voter lists need to be updated, but there's a real concern about how this goes about. There's been a lot of litigation on voter purge efforts, as I said, in states like Georgia and Ohio. In fact, the Supreme Court will be considering the Ohio case, litigation challenging the way that voters have been purged. There's allegations that in some of these jurisdictions, hundreds of thousands of voters have been unlawfully purged and therefore prevented from being able to register. And that's a real problem. And, you know, what is, I think, expressly concerning right now is that against a backdrop of very serious threats to our voting systems, and I'm talking from cyber attacks to old machines to discriminatory voter ID laws that numerous federal courts have found to have been intentionally racially discriminatory, to Russian interference with our elections, that the Pence-Kobach Commission, especially right now, is investing a lot of time and resources focusing on this so-called phantom problem of voter fraud, for which there simply is no systematic evidence. The Heritage Foundation has been keeping a list of voter fraud. They have allegedly found just over 1,000 cases dating back to 1945. Since 2000 alone, there have been 1 billion votes cast. And so, you know, we really have to wonder why it is that these efforts are being allowed to continue. And I think when you look at the composition of the commission with individuals like Kris Kobach, Glenn Beckwell, Hans von Spakovsky, J. Christian Adams, and you see President Trump's tweets about voter fraud, I think you have your answers there.
At the same time, in several states and jurisdictions, we've seen reports of voters pulling themselves off of voter lists. Why is that happening?
I think one of the most alarming things that's happened in the last few weeks is that Democratic and Republican local election officials are reporting that citizens are pulling themselves off of voter rolls out of fear that their personal information is being consolidated at the White House and is going to be leaked or hacked into. A Denver elections official said that her office has actually seen a 2,150% increase in voter registration withdrawals. A Republican election official out of Seminole, Florida, said that he is facing unprecedented demands and requests to withdraw voter registration. that is simply it's terrible. I mean, taking ourselves off of the rolls, I think, really means that we're giving the Trump administration exactly what it wants and is sacrificing our voices. And we need to make sure that people don't deregister for that reason.
Vanita Gupta, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Vanita Gupta is president and chief executive of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. She was head of the Civil Rights Division at the Justice Department in the Obama administration. You're listening to sounds there from a crowd of Palestinians chanting in protest on Friday to the installation of metal detectors at the entrance to the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. It's the third holiest site in the Islamic world, and security at the mosque has been heightened since the July 14th attack that left two Israeli guards dead. Yesterday, the Israeli government announced they would be removing those metal detectors in response to the uproar, but it remains unclear whether that will put an end to those protests. But the Al-Aqsa incident is just the latest in a string of escalations. On Sunday, a man attacked a guard at the Israeli embassy in Amman, Jordan. The guard killed the man and also shot a bystander, who later was pronounced dead. Ruth Eglash is a reporter for The Washington Post. She's in Jerusalem. Ruth, welcome.
Hi.
Confrontations at the Al-Aqsa Mosque are nothing new. It's part of the larger Temple Mount complex, holy to Jews and Muslims, a contentious place. What's caused the latest escalation?
Well, like you said, the latest escalation was sparked by an attack that happened a week and a half ago, where three young Palestinian men with Israeli citizenship burst out of the mosque and shot two Israeli police officers who were guarding the mosque regularly there. And these young men, who were actually from an Israeli Arab village in the Galilee, came out of the mosque with rifles and they shot the guards. And that sparked the latest round, which has been, it's been about 10 days now, of constant protests and clashes in Jerusalem and several other events in the West Bank. And you mentioned the one in Amman as well.
Now, Jordan has responsibilities for administering this mosque, so it gets complicated. And there's a diplomatic incident now surrounding the Israeli guard that I mentioned after the killing of an attacker and a bystander over in Jordan.
Exactly. Jordan is very much involved in the situation concerning the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, an arrangement that was reached between Israel and Jordan in 1967, where Israel allowed Jordan to take full responsibility for administering the mosque compound. So there's this complicated arrangement. And when things become contentious around that area in Jerusalem, then it's also taken on by many Muslims in Jordan who dislike the fact that Israel has any part of controlling the area around the mosque compound or go inside the mosque compound, which we saw happen 10 days ago after the police officers were shot. And there's also been simultaneous protests in Jordan, particularly near the Israeli embassy in Amman.
Of course, Jordan and Israel have a peace treaty. They're not at war. Are the two governments managing, despite the protests, to contain the situation?
Yeah, I think for both countries, it's in their interest to work together on the situation. The two countries not only have a peace agreement, but they also have very, very close security and strategic ties between the armies, the militaries, the secret services. They work together very much dealing with the situation in the entire region.
And in terms of the protests, Ruth, it seems like part of the question is why now? I mean, flare-ups and incidents aren't all that uncommon, unfortunately. And sometimes you come to find out that significant escalations in violence can be strategic as much as they are spontaneous. Is that the case here?
From what I've heard from people on the streets, that there's been tension around the site for a long time. Obviously, while the site is a Muslim site, it's also revered by Jewish believers who often want to visit the site. They want to pray at that site as well. And that causes a lot of contention, continual. There's almost never a quiet moment in Jerusalem when it comes to that site.
Ruth Eglash, reporter for The Washington Post in Jerusalem. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Major League Baseball held its All-Star Game in Miami earlier this month. And in a city where more than two-thirds of the population is Hispanic, the Latin American influence on the game was on full display. Before the game, living Latin American Hall of Famers and family members of deceased players threw out the ceremonial first pitch.
We are proud to welcome these baseball icons to the field. From Puerto Rico, Roberto Alomar. From the Dominican Republic, Pedro Martinez. And the newest member of the club from Puerto Rico, Ivan Rodriguez. Ladies and gentlemen, the Latin-born members of the Baseball Hall of Fame.
It was a fun day, but Dave Zirin says the celebration didn't address the whole complicated story of Latin Americans in pro baseball. Dave is sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast.
Latino, and by Latino, I mean Latin American-born players, now make up 29.5% of Major League Baseball players, and yet at the same time, there are no managers and no general managers of Latin American origin, and that's the first time in Major League Baseball that's been the case since 1991. And this is a big deal, because what we're talking about is not just a cultural schism, but we're talking about a historical schism as well, because baseball, it's often referred to as the America's pastime, as if it is just the United States. Yet baseball has been played in Latin America pretty much as long as it's been played in the United States, since the mid-19th century. And Major League Baseball's uneasy relationship with the fact that this is truly America's game in the broadest possible sense is a real problem, because it affects also how Major League Baseball markets its stars, and it affects, honestly, how players play on the field.
Well, let's go deeper than managers and general managers there. Talk about the players themselves and what does go on the field.
Absolutely. I mean, there is a tradition in Latin American baseball, and that's the idea of playing with flair, playing with swag, playing with the idea that baseball is a game that actually should be celebrated. You know, players throwing their bats, throwing their hats, really working the crowd, almost like a pro wrestling element to baseball itself. The idea that the hype is actually important and fan engagement is important. But in U.S. baseball's quote-unquote unwritten rules, even a slight deviation towards that kind of behavior means a ball's going to get thrown out of your head. You might be condemned by sports writers. And one of the problems with that is not just the cultural schism, which we discussed, but and also the safety of Latin American players if pitchers are throwing at their heads for doing a slow trot around the bases. But there's another aspect to it as well, because playing with that kind of flair actually connects really strongly with young fans. This is also about the future of Major League Baseball and whether it is or is not a dying sport.
Well, let's talk one of these differences, maybe specifically the bat flip. There's a lot of debate in baseball already between younger players and older players, younger pitchers and older pitchers. The younger guys, many of them say, yeah, I get the rules, I'll enforce the rules, but I just don't care as much as some 40-year-old reliever about a bat flip. I'm not going to throw in on a guy. Is this just something that's changing, regardless of the large proportions of Latin American players in the game?
I think it is, but it's happening, I think, even actually too slowly for Major League Baseball. And to take it to what you're saying, I think what you're seeing is not just these younger players resistant to the old school baseball ways, but let's remember, these are younger players also very influenced by social media, very influenced by the NBA, which has much more freedom in terms of what they allow players to do and how they're allowed to talk and dress. The example that I always give, I live in Washington, D.C., and if John Wall, the point guard for the Washington Wizards, walked into my kids' elementary school, there would be a riot. I mean, kids would be pouring out into the hallway just to get a glimpse of him. And if Bryce Harper walked into my kid's elementary school, he's the star slugger for the Washington Nationals, I think the school secretary would ask him to get a badge.
Oh, come on.
Oh, absolutely.
So you're making the point here, Dave, that baseball may be losing a good part of its appeal for younger fans. I think their ticket sales probably reflect that. At the same time, just sticking with the bat flip for a second, I mean, Jose Bautista on the Toronto Blue Jays had a famous, gigantic bat flip after hitting a monster home run walk-off in the ALCS last year. And it was celebrated. Nobody gave him a hard time for that.
It was polarizing more than it was celebrated. But let's remember what happened to Jose Bautista. He got punched in the face. by a player on the Texas Rangers. Interestingly, a Latino player whose name is Odor.
Right.
And what's so interesting about that is it shows the way the rules are enforced, this way of saying, if you are on this team, you will enforce these rules. And we're not going to accept any deviation from that, or you're not going to be seen as in the club, so to speak. And so that tension is very real. And that punch to the face, I thought, really said so much. And of course, you did have an older generation of sports writers and baseball people, certainly, who were absolutely appalled by the Batista flip. Meanwhile, it got shared a kajillion times on social media, and it was celebrated by precisely those kinds of millennial fans that baseball seems for some reason set upon alienating.
Part of what's standing in the way of Major League Baseball becoming more open and more sensitive to Latino culture and fans becoming more open to it is the idea that big league players, no matter who they are, already have it made. Nobody is concerned if Yasiel Puig comes to the United States and feels out of place because Yasiel Puig makes $80 million and poor baby.
Mm. The interesting point of your question is the title of Jackie Robinson's scathing memoir that he put out just a couple of years before he died was called I Never Had It Made. And it spoke exactly to the points that you just said, that Jackie Robinson was saying, even though I'm this star major leaguer, even though I've made money as a baseball player, even though it's afforded me so many opportunities, please know that being black in Major League Baseball also comes with a lot of pain and a lot of baggage and a lot of alienation. And I think we can fast forward that to the present day with a lot of these players. And Yasiel Puig is a great example to raise, because when Yasiel Puig came into Major League Baseball, again, it was that polarizing effect. He was almost like Jose Bautista's bat flip in human form. And I would argue that Yasiel Puig's career has been a disappointment. Like, we haven't gotten all out of Yasiel Puig that we could have gotten as baseball fans. And perhaps you can point to the fact that he's had to live a more constricted life on the field. So maybe the fans also suffer greatly, not just the players, from these kinds of constrictions.
Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you so much.
This is Todd Zwillick, and you're listening to The Takeaway. In July of 1969, 600 million Earthlings watched as Neil Armstrong became the first human to walk on the moon.
Surface is fine and battery. I can pick it up loosely with my toe. It does adhere in fine layers, like powdered charcoal.
It was the culmination of years of scientific development, but it was much more than that, too. The space race seems like a modern human competition.
The first artificial Earth satellite in the world has now been created in the USSR.
But before the Cold War and national power that drove the early orbiters and the moon landing, there were centuries of very human striving for prestige, for power, and yes, for curiosity.
That's one small step for man. One giant leap for mankind.
It's true, that moment on the moon was a giant leap, but the quest for space hasn't always been the purely noble quest we like to remember. And that's the subject of a new book by Dr. Alexander McDonald. He's senior economic advisor at NASA, and he's author of The Long Space Age, The Economic Origins of Space Exploration from Colonial America to the Cold War. He traces the space race not to 1945, but all the way back to the late 18th century.
Space exploration, because it is costly and complicated, serves as a signal, essentially, of the economic, organizational, and technological health of a nation, a group, or even an individual. The kings of England and France, Russia, the director of the East India Company, all over the world, this was a major endeavor, and different American groups decided that they were also going to contribute to this. The results were then published in the Transactions of the American Philosophical Society. And this became seen in Europe as a signal of the emerging sophistication of America, showing that they could contribute to world-class science in the 18th century.
Well, let's talk about some of the individuals, some of the rich people in the 1800s who wanted to pay for space exploration and for big telescopes. You tell the story of George Hale, and people will have heard of Hale Observatories. He's the guy who spent and raised tons, millions for telescopes.
Yeah, George Miller Hill is really one of the most fascinating characters in the history of space exploration or astronomy. He used his family's money to build his first observatory, but his endeavor to convince people of the world to support astronomy was really prolific. He would write articles prolifically in magazines at the times like Harper's. But what he would also do is write individual letters to all of these people that he was trying to raise money from. And he would engage in this gift-giving. He would be engaging these people as if they were scientific equals. And that was really one of his techniques, to engage them in the process of science so that when it came around to requiring support for that science, they'd be willing to do so.
What was Hale able to build with all this letter writing, this ability to get money out of rich people?
His two crowning achievements really were the Mount Wilson Observatory and then the Palomar Observatory. And the Palomar Observatory was a 200-inch reflector telescope. And when you read the histories of what it took to build this, you know, you had multi-segments of glass that were being cast at Corning. And really the story of the whole observatory really parallels a lot of the complex space exploration projects that we're familiar from today.
So that's the ground-based space exploration, Alex MacDonald. And then we go forward to World War II, of course, and then to the 50s. And people know about the modern space race and how important that was to the Cold War. I mean, you talk about signaling. There was a great deal of motivation on the part of the Americans and the Soviets to get to a satellite first, get into orbit first. But can you talk about how politics and national signaling sort of interacted with technology and scientific achievement? Because during the Cold War, they kind of became one big ball of progress.
In 1957, it's important to think about what it would have been like to be somewhere in the world, like, for example, Ghana or Thailand, where you don't really know a lot about the Soviet Union or about the United States of America. But if you know one thing for certain about one of those countries, which is that one of those countries has sent something into the cosmos and the other has not, then you actually know something fundamentally important about the technological capacity of those countries, and that will influence your alliance decisions. And that was really what the space race was about. You know, that's why as an economist, I tend to kind of think of these as somewhat of the, you know, quote-unquote supply and demand sides of the equation, right? So you have the question of why do people really work on these incredibly hard technological projects for their whole life? And that really comes down to the intrinsic motivations that a lot of them feel regarding the importance of humanity exploring the cosmos. But that doesn't necessarily provide the funding for those projects. And so what's the demand source? And often the demand source is a desire by some entity, and sometimes it's a government, sometimes it's a wealthy individual, or sometimes it's a community, who want to signal their sophistication. And if a space explorer, entrepreneur, or scientist has a particular project that will provide that type of signal, then you have the type of exchange that can allow, you know, for both of these sides of the equation to realize a project.
So today on YouTube, when I watch videos, which I often do, of Elon Musk's SpaceX rocket that can descend and land on the dot on a barge, what's he doing? Is he signaling to businesses that he can take their payloads to space, or is he signaling to the rest of us just how great an explorer and what a rich guy he is?
Well, for me, I think actually it's pretty clear that Elon Musk has a real genuine intrinsic motivation in the exploration of the cosmos. I mean, it's easy at this point to kind of look at that and say, oh, well, he's been very successful and therefore he must be trying to signal something. But it's important to remember that he started this project 17 years ago or so. Both he and Jeff Bezos are really following very long-held intrinsic motivations. At the same time, they nonetheless have the effect of signaling the sophistication of their companies.
You know, one of the things I was able to take away from your book, Alex MacDonald, is the inherent human need for exploration. We congratulate ourselves for it all the time. We go to Mars because it's there, because it's the next place. That has a value to us as humans, but it also winds up having an economic value. People will pay for the privilege to be part of it, to be the champion of it, to be on the trip, or to even work on it.
Humans have this enduring need to explore the cosmos, to be part of a journey that reveals new wonders in the solar system. And that this is a process that's been going on for, at this point, hundreds of years in this country. And that even when there isn't necessarily government support at a certain level, private individuals also have that motivation and often provide some of the funds that are required to keep progress moving on.
Somebody who hears you say that, though, might think, well, that's fine. He's helping to make excuses for an agency that's had its budget cut, that needs to assure people that space exploration will still be okay if the Elon Musks and the Jeff Bezoses of the world are paying for it. Don't worry, if Congress cuts NASA, it'll be all right.
Well, for one thing, I mean, Elon Musk is not paying for this himself. I mean, NASA is actually his largest customer. You know, if you add up all the observatories in the book, it only reaches about $8 billion of funding or so in today's terms as a share of the GDP. You know, NASA's budget is about $19 billion annually. If we want a space exploration project and a space exploration program that is worthy of the United States of America, then it must be the people of the country who pay for it.
The book is The Long Space Age, The Economic Origins of Space Exploration from Colonial America to the Cold War. Dr. Alex MacDonald, Senior Economic Advisor for NASA. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, Alex MacDonald makes it clear space exploration isn't going anywhere. We have too much at stake. We've been asking you, what space discoveries are you hoping to see in your lifetime?
This is Andrew calling from The Colony, Texas. I'd love to see faster than light travel, possibility of being a tourist even to other bodies in our solar system, let alone other stars, would realize my childhood dream.
Hi, my name is Sarah. I'm calling from Leeburg, Oregon. And I feel that confirmation of any form of life beyond Earth would be incredible. To know that we're not it would present so many philosophical, ethical, and spiritual puzzles.
Your take on the future of space travel. Give us your take, 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. That's all for us today. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Netflix, presenting The Incredible Jessica James, a new romantic comedy starring Jessica Williams and Chris O'Dowd. This Netflix original film starts streaming July 28th. From Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. The Takeaway is supported by the Arkansas Economic Development Commission and the state committed to acting quickly and decisively on corporate interests. Learn more about how Arkansas works for businesses at ArkansasEDC.com.